I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Mom deserves the best, and there's no better place to shop for Mother's Day than Whole Foods Market. They're your destination for unbeatable savings, from premium gifts to show-stopping flowers and irresistible desserts. Start by saving 33% with Prime on all body care and candles. Then get a 15-stem bunch of tulips for just $9.99 each with Prime. Round out Mom's menu with festive rosé, irresistible berry chantilly cake, and more special treats. Come celebrate Mother's Day at Whole Foods Market.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. At Mint Mobile, we like to do the opposite of what Big Wireless does. They charge you a lot, we charge you a little. So naturally, when they announced they'd be raising their prices due to inflation, we decided to deflate our prices due to not hating you. That's right. We're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month slows. Full terms at mintmobile.com.
Chase Thomas podcast. The Chase Thomas podcast. My nephew needs me to record. See, I already hate it.
All right, hello, and welcome back to another episode of the Chase Thomas podcast, taping this on a Thursday afternoon where I am still the aforementioned Chase Thomas, coming to you live from Knoxville, Tennessee. Also here in Knoxville, Tennessee, my good friend Stats by Will over there in the Ridge of the Oak area. Will, good afternoon, sir. How are you?
I'm doing pretty well. This weather has been amazing lately, by the way.
Yes, the weather is great. I'm hoping you're taking full advantage with your runs in this weather. Pour one out for me on all your runs. I'm just a fallen runner in these trying times.
I'm trying to break my own half marathon record tomorrow. I think by the time people listen to this, it will technically be, quote, today. So
yes.
9:30. Mm-hmm. So hopefully, fingers crossed, by the time people are listening to this, I will have maybe not shattered, but, you know, slightly broken my old record.
Very much we're getting into our old man portion of our lives is that, like, I think you're probably the same here, where I'm so excited for October weather and just the month of October, which is undoubtedly the best month every year. Like, I am just so excited for October. That just it's going to be amazing.
Yes, 100%. If you have a month ranked ahead of October,
you're wrong.
In your month rankings, please see us in the office.
Absolutely. Will, we do have some fun college basketball stuff, because this is, as we say each week, ostensibly a college basketball show here on the program. I think we start. We kind of built off this last week when we were talking about NC State and whether or not Kevin Keats was the right guy for the Wolfpack, and if this could get turned around at any point in Raleigh. You can check that out here on the Chase Thomas podcast if you've not already done so. Previous episodes from last week. You can also look at this week, where you may have done some digging, Will, and found that there is actually one coach who has done even less with more than Kevin Keats and NC State. So who is that, and what was the process in just getting to this point?
So Keats is definitely up there among the sports leading underachievers. I don't think that's like a real argument, but I ran the numbers out of curiosity. And again, I would like to preface this. This is not scientific. This is something I cooked up a couple nights ago, and it had a fairly good correlation to overall program success. So I was pleased with most of the results. But this was using, so Bart Torvik has what is called a projected talent metric. And that's kind of like your effective talent combined with your average stars. So, like, you know, it kind of combines, like, did you recruit well? Also, do you have, like, experienced old guys coming back? Naturally, it does benefit. Like, you're not going to be shocked to hear that Duke ranks number one in this metric of the last 4 years. Not a shocker. And I cross-checked that with the average star rating on my beloved Verbal Commits. Great page. So among top 50 recruiters the last 4 years, nobody has underachieved more with their personnel than Stanford's Jared Haas. I think he/Stanford fly under the radar, because you know, in your head, they're not like a traditional Pac-12 power, right?
Mm-hmm.
But you and I are old enough to remember the year Stanford went undefeated before their final game, and two, the Lopez twins. Like, Stanford was very good when I was growing up under Mike Montgomery and Trent Johnson.
Mm-hmm.
And they've certainly dwindled away since. And, you know, you can kind of see that happening with their football program as well. I don't know as much about their other programs, but the top two, obviously women's basketball doing really well,
mm-hmm.
but the top two not doing so hot. That being said,
also a great baseball program.
Yes. So I don't think people know this, but in terms of average talent and average star rating last 4 years, Stanford ranks 19th in all of college basketball in terms of talent. Like, they've had some pretty good guys like Casey Okpala, Tyrell Terry, Zaire Williams, all Stanford guys. I mean, all NBA draft picks.
Mm-hmm.
Would you like to guess how many times Jared Haas in his 6 years has either finished in the top 40 of KenPom or made the NCAA tournament?
Once?
Zero. Zero.
I was
going to
say, because I feel like the 3 years ago, they were pretty solid. Was that the COVID year where they were actually like kind of...
The COVID year, they were right on the cut line. I went back and looked at bracket matrix, and I think they were the first team out. So
last memory I have of Stanford being decent was the COVID year.
Yes. Yes. And so, like, figuring out college basketball recruiting is frankly 100% impossible. Like, in terms of, like, you know, getting it all the way through, knowing all the connections, knowing how it's all going to work. But as best as I can tell, Haas's lead recruiter on most of those guys, including the three NBA draft picks, was Adam Cohen.
Mm-hmm.
So he's an assistant who was at Vandy under Stallings and then was with Haas at Stanford for all 6 years. Cohen left in April for Xavier.
Mm-hmm.
And so if your case for the job before you got it was pretty flimsy, I mean, it seems to me it was based off the back of one NCAA tournament win at UAB. Your reason for most of your best talent is gone and you still haven't made the tournament. What exactly is it that you're doing here?
Mm-hmm.
And so I think if they don't make the NCAA tournament this year, which frankly seems likely, Stanford's going to move on, and I'm very curious to see what they do.
It's weird because if you look at those Mike Montgomery records, like, he was killing it at Stanford, and then he goes to Cal, and I mean, Cal has not been the same since Montgomery was let go too. I mean, if you go through those Cal teams, they were making the tournament consistently under him, and it just, they have not been able to get the guy, because I think, I mean, I'm not sure how you felt about Haas at the time, but like, Johnny Dawkins was a celebrated hire. It was like, oh, that makes a lot of sense. The Duke background, Stanford, West Coast, like, this makes sense. Like, you get the thought process there. It still just didn't really ever work. Like, they just never got to that, like, Mike Montgomery was going 30-2, 24-9, 31-3. Like, Dawkins' best year was 24-13. You look at Jared Haas' best year is 20-12. Like, they've never gotten back. I mean, we're now looking at 20 years of the last time Stanford was an elite, elite basketball program.
Yeah, and it's like, Haas is, by all accounts, a pretty good guy. Mm-hmm. I don't want to discount that, so... I mean, that's a good thing, but
none of these are mean-spirited. We're just saying, like, why is this the case? Yeah,
it's just like, well, especially, you know, given like his quote success at UAB. I mean, he did make the NCAA tournament. He won a game as a 14 seed. You can't discount that.
Mm.
And the year after, they probably should have made it, but lost in the conference tournament as the one seed.
Mm-hmm.
That being said, I kind of feel like that gets discounted a little bit when you see Andy Kennedy at UAB right now, and both of his UAB teams are better than anything Haas ever had. I think that's kind of a problem. So I don't know.
And he's got a great, like, just resume, like his time at Kansas under Roy Williams, and then he follows Roy to North Carolina, and he was there for a long time. And he played at Kansas.
And I think we should reiterate, it is not difficult, at least in my head, to recruit to Stanford. I know there's academic restrictions, but of all states to be recruiting in, California is flooded with good athletes who are smart.
Yeah, I would agree.
I mean, you have your chance. So they got to get somebody else in there. And it's not like, I mean, dating back to when he was hired, I'm not sure off the top of my head who the regional options were available at the time.
Mm-hmm.
But I wonder if there's a guy out there, you know, like, none immediately come to mind, but it could be Cohen, even as an assistant now at Xavier. Who's the guy who comes in, replaces that, who can get the guys, but then coaches them up? And I mean, I don't feel like their fans are asking for much. They're just asking for, like, let's make the tournament, you know, two out of every 3 to 4 seasons. I think that's a reasonable request.
I mean, I'm looking at Kyle Smith, though, if I'm Stanford.
Oh, yeah.
I would be looking at somebody like that, just pulling one of the smaller West Coast programs that are finding success.
Kyle Smith or Nico Medved at Colorado State.
That's another good pull. Good pull. But it's also like we've liked ostensibly their last two pulls and it just hasn't worked out. So I don't know. Yeah. It's just a weird one. I agree, though, that Stanford should be better and they should figure this out. Coaching tiers. Who fits in the top couple tiers for you, Will, right now?
So The Athletic had this list earlier this week. Mm-hmm. It was Dana O'Neill and somebody else. I don't think it was just those two. They pulled a bunch of coaches and tastemakers and whatnot. Mm-hmm. But their top tier is eight coaches. Tony Bennett, Coach Cal, Scott Drew, Mark Few, Izzo, Patino, Kelvin Sampson, and Bill Self. And I think it's pretty darn hard to argue against any of those eight. Mm-hmm. I mean, in terms of resumes, I don't really think there's a ninth that matches it in college basketball. Hmm. The only one of those guys who is not, or actually two of those guys, I think, who have not won a title are Mark Few and Kelvin Sampson. And they've had the two best programs over the last 4 years. So it's like I'm not really sure who the ninth would be. This might be mildly controversial. I really don't know. If I had to name a ninth, or like a guy who's on the cusp, who's like an accomplishment away from getting there, you could go with one of three. I think you could go with obviously Rick Barnes, Bruce Pearl, or Matt Painter at Purdue. I think those three, they're like on the cusp. They could get there. Like Chris Beard is kind of in that convo too, though I feel like his star is like faded somehow. But if any of those three ever get that elusive Final Four or title game bid, I guess, I mean, Auburn did make the Final Four, but if they make the title game, I think they can make that jump. Because at all three of those schools, getting a Final Four or title game bid is a massive accomplishment.
I think you could, I mean, Mick Cronin is just on the periphery there a little bit too. And I would even throw,
I'm more of seeing him as like a top 20 guy. I do think he had the UCLA Final Four success, but he did have a lot of disappointing marches with Cincinnati.
Yeah, I wonder. I mean, the bottom tier too is like and we're not saying bottom like one of the worst, but like this just weird group, like Tommy Lloyd, you could see rising there relatively soon.
Jawan.
You can see that. We'll see what happens with Brad Underwood over the next couple of years, because I think he's probably on that teeter where those teams are going to be consistently really good and he's recruited well. And I don't know. He has to win a little bit more in March to get to that point. But Anthony Grant is someone I would also keep an eye on, because, I mean, he just got kind of screwed with the 2020 year. He was like Dayton was the ultimate 2020 screwed team. But I would not be surprised if he just keeps building, and he's someone to watch out for in the next couple of years as a tier two, tier one guy.
There are only two on this list that I actually got a little offended by not being higher. Mark Adams at Texas Tech and Brian Dutcher at San Diego State. So both are in tier four alongside such luminaries as Penny Hardaway and Mike White. And I think I'm going to go out on a limb here. Mark Adams and Brian Dutcher are better coaches than those two guys.
I also think Steve Forbes is a little undervalued here.
It is kind of a deal where like they should have made the tournament last year. And I don't know how much you can control that. But if he continues to build at Wake, he's going to rise. But it's like Adams owns the best defense in college basketball. Dutcher, I mean, we're 5 years past Steve Fisher now, and Dutcher has had three of the five best San Diego State teams in the last 40 years. I'm not exactly sure what more he has to do to get recognized nationally, because
he's maybe a Stanford target.
I mean, I don't think they could draw him away. I feel like San Diego State's got a lot of money.
Yeah, he's 119-40 career, 74% winning percentage. He's been just elite throughout his time. That's a good pull.
I mean, imagine giving the Arizona State roster to Brian Dutcher. They might win the Pac-12.
Interesting. You really just want to, you're just anti.
But we'll get into it later at a later date, but I've got games circled on my personal calendar this year, and a couple involve Arizona State.
Well, speaking of Memphis a little bit and Penny Hardaway, they are not going to suffer any kind of serious repercussions for what happened in the James Wiseman case that came to a close this week. Was there anything that jumped out to you about the infractions and what it means for Memphis basketball in the short term?
Not much. I mean, the recruiting probation is interesting. Coaches are able to get around that a little bit, but it's you can't like sugarcoat it too much. Like, it will make it a little more difficult. Like, you can't be as far much in contact, like he can't have as many guys on the road. But I think the biggest thing is it's pretty light, and I think it's a big win that there's no postseason punishment whatsoever. And with that, I think we need to have a conversation about Oklahoma State getting big time screwed with their year off from the NCAA tournament for basically the same infractions.
Mm.
So I think it's like, and I understand Memphis is a higher profile program than Oklahoma State in every regard, but either give Memphis the same punishment for basically the same crime or don't punish either. At this point, I'd prefer the latter, don't punish either, because the NCAA has no ability to find any sort of consistent ground in any punishment anywhere.
Mm-hmm.
So I don't know. I'm all right with Memphis coming off light. And I mean, given it's just, you know, as far as we know, one player, James Wiseman, and it did technically happen before Penny was the Memphis head coach. I don't feel like it's a big deal. I'm frankly much more interested to see what happens with the LSU case whenever it's resolved in about 2028 or so.
Interesting. Well, we'll see what ultimately happens. I think it's not a talent issue, though. Maybe that's a good thing, is that they have to focus less on recruiting and more on actual in-game adjustments and being a better team on the floor, not an ostensibly talented team that should be great. It's actually like what actually should happen on the floor.
Yeah,
not a theoretical
team. They're doing something interesting. It's the Memphis Play Basketball in December challenge this year, which they have failed for 4 years running. So I'm excited to see what they can do against literally any team of note in a month that is not February or March.
There you go. We shall see. We shall see, my friend. Syracuse. There was a really good piece on ESPN.com that I highly encourage folks to go read by Myron Metcalf, who wrote about he's just one of the premier college basketball writers in the country, and always read Myron whenever you can. He's just, he's great. He wrote about Jim Boeheim, though. And we talked about him a little bit on the periphery, right? Where Syracuse, obviously, they don't land JP Estrella. He goes to Tennessee. The recruiting has really petered off in recent years, and the Mello years and the Jerry McNamara years. And I mean, even the Tyler Ennis years are long gone. And this is just not a program that's putting dudes in the league anymore. It doesn't really have that kind of juice that it used to have that we grew up with. And I wonder, like, when he does retire, like, did he stay too long where Syracuse is now just kind of in a bind with the future? And they've just, it's just sad. Like, Syracuse not being an elite basketball program, it's just, it doesn't feel right. And they've just kind of petered off, and they're just not real challengers. And we don't see a path with these remaining Boeheim years coaching this team, getting back to national prominence. I don't know. Like, what do you think the future of this job looks like? And do you think there is a path to Syracuse getting back to what they were?
It's kind of a tough one, right? I mean, I think the answer is twofold. So in theory, it could be one of like the top 10 to 15 jobs in college basketball, because you have good recruiting proximity to New York, and a lot of like good Midwest talent that people don't really talk about. Like, Buffalo is a pretty solid basketball city. The tradition, obviously, you got the national championship, you have like all those Final Fours, all those wins Boeheim has built up over the years. You have a rock solid program identity. If there's one thing everybody knows about Syracuse, one, the Carrier Dome, two, the orange uniforms, three, the 2-3 zone. Everybody who has watched like college basketball more than a few times knows of Syracuse and knows what they do generally. And that's why it likely will not be one of the premier jobs, because the recruiting, like you mentioned, has fallen behind other ACC foes. So same study I did for Stanford. Syracuse's four-year recruiting average, and they used to be a yearly top two or three team in this, now down to fifth in the ACC over the last 4 years, seventh over the last two. So they're like a mid-pack side. They're West Ham in the ACC. I don't know if people realize this either, given the Final Four, you know, magic run. Last top 25 finish they had in KenPom was 2014. That's 8 years ago now. I think the program is now more identified as one that sleepwalks for 4 months before vexing 20-year-olds that suddenly don't know how to break down a 2-3 zone in March. And I mean, that it's kind of like, you know, Boeheim's still one of the greats. I don't feel like it's a crazy thing to say that, and to say, like, you know, he still has something in there. At the same time, I don't think it's wild at all to say his best days are far behind him. I mean, if you think about it, the best player Syracuse has had in the last, I don't know, 6-7 years is Buddy Boeheim, a literal gym relative. So you have to go, I mean, who was the best, you know, prior to him?
Ennis?
I mean, maybe you might have to go all the way back to, like, yeah, Tyler Ennis or even like Johnny Flynn, Wes Johnson.
I was going
to
say,
to find like the last marquee Syracuse player.
It's not great.
It really isn't. And I think, you know, he reasonably could have called it a day 3 or 4 years ago. Because the longer he hangs on and the more Syracuse's standards slip, I mean, you know, again, we say this disclaimer every time, projections aren't everything, but they're projected to finish 74th by Torvik. The less attractive this job is going to be on the open market, because one, you're replacing a coaching legend, two, who has ensured that you're going to need at least a couple of years to dig out of what he's left behind, if not longer, if you plan on not running his own. It's not going to be a very optimal situation for a coach to step into. And they're, I mean, frankly, their best hope might be that Jim calls it quits after this year and they can just go hire Colgate's Matt Langle, a younger guy who they know has New York ties, is well-versed in the region. You got to get somebody who's going to come in there, you know, be okay with the traditions, be okay and be, you know, flexible with what he runs, but also just have more of like a day-to-day spirit, I feel.
It's also kind of weird that like, they have not been great, but they still have just found ways when they make the tournament to win several games. Like, it just, you go through it and you're like, man, when was the last? And you're like, oh, they made the Sweet 16 2 years ago. Oh, they went to the Sweet 16 in 2017, 2018. Oh, they went to the Final Four in 2015, 2016. You go through it and it's like the wins haven't been there and it's been like a rough watch for Syracuse. But like come tournament time, for whatever reason, they just over, they just, not overexert, but they just kind of do more than the sum of their parts. And it's kind of weird that they've had this success that they've actually had.
It's kind of like, it's like the reverse of how, do you remember like under Paul Johnson, how you would always want to catch Georgia Tech in a bowl because you had a month to prepare?
Right. Rather than a week of digital option. Yeah.
It's the reverse of that, where it's like, if you catch Syracuse on March 17th, you are screwed. But if you catch Syracuse on January 17th, that's going to be okay.
Yeah, that's a good way of looking at it. I would agree with that. Next up, because man, remember when they were on national television this year and got waxed by Duke, like just in the Carrier Dome, and it was just, it was over in like the first 5 minutes. That was rough. Yeah, poor Syracuse. Texas Tech, they lose a big transfer to a broken foot, who I think a lot of folks were excited about. And Texas Tech, you mentioned Mark Adams and just him being undervalued. A lot of folks don't even have them in the tournament next year, Will. And I wonder from your perspective with this injury and with where this roster looks right now. So Fardaz, I don't know how to pronounce his last name. He's 6'11".
IMEC was my best guess, but yeah, that could be very wrong.
But he was a absolute menace at Utah Valley and was just a huge rebounding guy and was going to fill in nicely, and he made a lot of sense defensively for Texas Tech, and he was going to be an important player. They don't lose him for the season, but it's going to be a while before you see him back on the floor for Texas Tech. But when you look at the Red Raiders, do you see this being a tournament team? Are you pretty concerned now with the depth? Are you optimistic that they're going to be okay?
I'm still pro them being a tournament team.
Okay.
I was roughly as high in them as ESPN is. ESPN had them 24th prior to the injury. I would project them about like 10 spots worse than that post-injury. I mean, it's kind of, I'm not a doctor, first off. I merely have an English major. But given the rough average for recovery from a broken foot being about 3 months, you can expect IMAC to be on the bench for at least all of non-conference play. And, you know, given that he's bigger, that could hamper the recovery process a little more. It's a little tougher to project it with, like, you know, 6'11" dudes than it is 6'1" guys like me. I'm not as high on IMAC as others are. He shot 47% on twos against WAC competition, which, given all of his athletic advantages, that's pretty alarming. Mm-hmm. But there's zero doubting his greatness as a rebounder and foul drawer. Also a very solid rim protector. The big issue here is going to be what they do at center if while he's out. Because they have Daniel Bacho, who is not a bad backup option, but they certainly, as far as I could tell, were not expecting him to start this year. He's not exactly, I mean, it's kind of like at the rough value of like if Tennessee were forced to start Juras Plavšić for an entire season without, and like give him, you know, 25 minutes a night. Mm-hmm. It's not catastrophic, but it's far from the outcome you were hoping for when you had a better option. So the hope here is like, you know, they might struggle through non-conference and even the first month of Big 12, but I trust Adams to get this team to the NCAA tournament. And, you know, if they come out like 10 spots worse than that ESPN rankings, like, you know, 34th or so, not really like the 8 or 9 seed you're looking forward to drawing. So I still feel all right about them, but like you were hinting at, the margin for error, it's getting erased a little bit.
Offseason winners and losers. This was from CBS Sports that I thought was interesting by David Cobb. He has winners Duke, you're not gonna believe this, loser Arizona, winner Indiana. I thought it was interesting, loser Louisville. There's a lot of like, just are we really concerned about what Kenny Payne's building? And I'm not there yet, and let's just see what happens with DJ Wagner before we really get a little bit too crazy with Kenny Payne at Louisville. But one that I think you're all in on is Creighton. I think you're big with your Schneiderman love. So when you look at this list, who jumps out to you and do you agree most with most of them?
Most of them. I think, like you, I'm a little hesitant to call out a bad start for Louisville just because it's, you know, they're kind of digging out of a big hole. But I would agree with most of the winners and losers here. I think Virginia, a huge winner by virtue of returning everybody. Mm-hmm. Bring back 91% of their minutes. They're going to be very good. Indiana is going to be another continuation all-star. Let me tell you, my big winner, obviously Creighton. Mm-hmm. My big loser, all of us, because this first week of college basketball is trash. I was looking at the schedule this past week. Generally, at least from my memory, you know, that first Tuesday is always awesome, right? Because usually, mm-hmm. I feel like every year it's Kentucky, Kansas, or Kentucky, Duke on the first Tuesday. The best game of the first 2 days this year is Memphis Vanderbilt.
Mm.
Real bad.
Yeah.
So I don't know what exactly happened this year because like all of the interesting games have been shoved to the next week. So like November 15th has Duke, Kansas, Michigan State, Kentucky, San Diego State, Stanford, etc. But like, what are we doing for this first week, guys? Get those good games going.
Man, well, we'll see.
I would also like to disagree with the concept that Villanova is a loser because I think Neptune is good and they have a really good roster coming back.
Yeah.
And with Arizona, because I know Arizona like lost quite a bit to the draft.
Mathurin going away, but
I trust in what they brought back. And two, I do think Tommy Lloyd is a fabulous coach. So I've still got them as a top 15 team.
I would agree. I think they're both going to be fine. I'm not worried about Arizona or Villanova. They're in good hands. They're going to be okay. We wrap here, Will, with our season in review. The UCLA Bruins. We alluded to Mick Cronin, the job that he has done to this point. We talked about whether or not this starting five was going to be potentially a Final Four team and one of the best in basketball this year. What do you make of Mick Cronin's most recent year following the Final Four run and what he did to build off that? Sustainable? You a believer, all in on Cronin in Los Angeles? Will?
They're a really interesting team to talk about, especially in the context of this past year. We kind of made it through that offseason where every single outlet had them top five. More or less based off the strength of the Final Four run, because they were not like super special in the regular season. And proceeded, this is a team that proceeded to win 27 games, beat Villanova, beat Arizona, beat St. Mary's, which I know that sounds weird, but is no small feat last year. Went 15-5 in conference, basically didn't have a bad loss. and it's seen as a massively disappointing season. And it's weird to say that, but that's kind of like the context of when you open top five and you end up a four seed and lose in the Sweet 16 in a very winnable game. But they're kind of a victim of expectations because you look at their KenPom page. Please guess the lowest ranking they had on KenPom during the entire season.
23rd?
15th.
Okay.
Never once did they dip out of the top 15.
Hmm.
That's a great run. And more than half of the season, they were in the top 10. But it's seen as kind of this, you know, minor failure of sorts because they supposedly had this generational roster and didn't quite capitalize. But when you have the final four in the rear view, I think that makes things better. And really, given the talent they had and the talent that's coming back, I don't think there's a ton to worry about with UCLA. Again, I'm feeling them as, you know, a low-end top 10 team. I think Cronin's really got the ball rolling there. They've got a lot of talent. I cannot wait to see my man Jaime Jaquez Jr. out there again. My favorite player in college basketball, 2 years running. It's the headband. It's just the headband, man.
It is the headband.
But the freshmen, they've got just a great freaking freshman class coming in. Tiger Campbell back for another year. I feel really good about them. But they're so interesting to me because, and I know we brought this up a couple months ago, of North Carolina. Because we're more or less looking at the same situation. North Carolina, you know, wasn't much of anything special last year prior to the NCAA tournament, but they got hot at the right time, ripped off five straight wins, and just like UCLA, came within 3 points of a massive all-time upset that would have sent them to the stratosphere.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm having a hard time seeing people balance the season-long North Carolina and Hubert success with 6 games of what happened. And I feel like we just ran into the same trap with UCLA. The good thing for North Carolina is, like, if they did the same thing UCLA did and were a top 10 to 15 team all year the second year, to me, that's still a massive success for Hubert in year two. But it's going to be, if they finish lower than fifth, people are going to look at it as, like, a minor failure of sorts.
It's also just the play style. Like, I think that's part of it, too, is just this is a defensive first mindset, and they're just going to annoy the crap out of everybody. Like, it's just that kind of play style is just never gonna be all that fun to watch on TV for a lot of folks. And UNC is just, they don't play like that, and it's a very different vibe and look. And I don't know, I if you had to guess who has the better squads over the next couple of years, who do you believe in more, Cronin or Hubert Davis over the next three?
I think Hubert's just got more fertile recruiting ground built in, but
I mean,
their roster is more talented this year. And so, like, you know, I'd give the slight edge to UNC. But Cronin does have the longer and deeper track record of player development and program development, which plays in his favor. I mean, this is technically, like, in theory, this should be, like, a slight down year for UCLA, given that they only returned 45% of scoring. But they're projected to be more or less exactly as strong as they were the last 2 years. So Cronin's got a good thing going there, and I'm really excited to watch them. And, you know, I think UCLA is the favorite in the Pac-12. I don't feel like that's super controversial to say. I mean, their main competition probably will be Arizona. But yeah, I'm really excited to see what they do. I think they're going to be more or less the same as last year. And that's a good thing for college basketball. I think it's funny we brought North Carolina up, my own doing, of course. It's good to see these two, honestly, through and through blue bloods, back at the top.
Well, can you also explain to me North Carolina only having one, they have a 1 5-star, they have one commit in the 2023 class right now. That's
but
weird.
But it's early, very early.
I mean, but a lot of them already committed. You go through this list, I mean, you're looking at Bradshaw, Collier, and then Wagner's obviously not an option for UNC. I don't know. Like, they're not going to get one of the top 10 players in this class.
Well, yeah, but they've got, like, if they can convince, like, Caleb Love, RJ Davis, Tuff Johnson, et cetera, to come back for an extra year, they'll be, I mean, with NIL, they're going to have a real shot at doing so.
Without looking, who would you guess has 3 4-stars and 1 5-star commit in the 2023 class?
It's going to be somebody insane. I don't know. Let's go with Texas Tech.
No. I'll give you a hint. Northeast.
It's not Syracuse.
It's not Syracuse. And they're in the top three in 247.
St. John's?
Closer, Big East school.
It's not Villanova.
Not Villanova. Xavier's 10 right now, by the way.
I'm like doing the mental calculus in my head of Big East school. Providence.
No. Damn. Do you want me to just tell you?
Is it UConn?
It is UConn.
There we go. I knew it because I follow No Escalators on Twitter, and every time they have something good happen, that guy retweets like 15 of his own posts.
UConn's back. UConn's back. Get the Dunkin' Donuts ready. Jim Calhoun, he's brought him back. That's Hurley's doing all right.
Dan Hurley, underrated coach.
See, you're all in on that Hurley, just the Arizona State Hurley.
He inherited all of the good coaching genes. Bobby has the looks, though.
Oh, my God. That's true. Wait, hold on. They look the exact same. What are we talking about?
Bobby doesn't have glasses. And that's true. Like, glasses are perfectly fine.
We're two glasses-wearing guys right now. Where are you going with this?
Dan looks nerdy.
He does look nerdy.
Bobby looks like a pretty, suave guy.
Hmm.
Better hairline, too, I think, which plays in his factor.
Wow.
Or in his favor.
Wow. And you're wearing glasses, you're a contacts guy, right?
Yes.
I don't know how you do that. They're doing that for my wedding and everything else, man. It's over. I'll never have contacts in my eye again. Like, if I am ever not wearing glasses, it's because I got myself LASIK, but we'll have to put me down for something like that. I don't know if I can sit there in the process. Pretty terrifying. Will, what can the good folks check out from you at statsbywill.com? Anything else this week you'd like to plug?
One, I'm making my triumphant return to writing, I think October 20th.
There you go.
Two, I do have a stats that have caught your eye section.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
This is for the blog in the future, but mm-hmm. might as well drop it now because it was so interesting to me, I couldn't sit on it.
Mm-hmm.
So I've been working, same kind of gist as the earlier stuff. I've been working on a study where I found what teams overperform their preseason KenPom projections with the highest regularity.
Mm-hmm.
Can you guess what team, and it's a regional team to us, not only overachieved every year the last 4 years, but overachieved by an average of 8 points per 100 possessions? This is the most in college basketball. Which team?
Say it one more time.
Which team overachieved the most of any college basketball program versus the KenPom projections the last 4 years? And it's a regional team to us.
Regional team to us. Arkansas?
Mid-major.
Oh. Murray State?
It's in-state.
Oh, Belmont?
It's Chattanooga, formerly Chattanooga. By Lamont Paris.
There you go.
Now, here's a fun follow-up. So, 16 programs underachieved every year in that same time span. So, they came in under what KenPom had preseason.
Mm.
Would you like to guess which team underachieved the second most in college basketball the last 4 years, average of 4.19 points worse than expected?
Louisville?
South Carolina, which is where Lamont Paris now coaches. By the way, very interesting. We've had like an endless narrative about how good Frank Martin is. But anyway.
Who's over at UMass now, right?
Yeah, we'll see how that goes for him. It's actually like probably regionally more appropriate for him.
UMass should be a better job, man. Like it Marcus Camby, like UMass is, there's a lot of good players over there. UMass should be better.
But I was seeing this and like, I don't bet, but if I did, I'd be like, South Carolina's over whatever their win total is this year. I feel pretty good about that.
Mm.
That's too big of a difference to not be like, oh man, they're going to overachieve this year and be like pretty frisky. I don't feel like they're going to be any good, but they have GG Jackson and some interesting
pieces.
That's
so weird.
They're going to be the team that's like, they finish 9th or 10th in the SEC, but it just annoys you whenever you have to play them.
Mm.
They're like the new Ole Miss.
Interesting. I mean, Tennessee really kicked the crap out of them last year. I don't know. Yeah. We'll see. I think we're a good... Well, that was the Frank Martin. So we'll see with Lamont. Like, when was the last time Tennessee played Chattanooga? I feel like they haven't played them in a long time.
The COVID year, 2019-20.
They did? Okay.
Yeah. Very, very boring game.
Yeah, that's a... Bring back Belmont. That's my main thing, is like, get Belmont on the calendar every year. Also, just the Memphis stuff, like, that should just happen every year, too. Like, the fans want it. Memphis, Tennessee should happen every year in basketball.
Well, there just needs to be, like, a State of Tennessee tournament every year, I think.
There's enough talent. You could do it. MTSU, you could throw in there. ETSU, sometimes, okay. Like, you could do a little tournament in the state of Tennessee.
Well, it's just like at minimum, Belmont and MTSU should play each other every year. Like do a home and home like they do with Lipscomb.
Yeah, there you go. Will, thank you as always, my friend. Go follow him on Twitter if you have not already. Stats by Will. And bookmark his website as he gets ready to dive back into writing next month. Statsbywill.com. Bookmark it today. Will, I will talk to you next week, my friend.
Thanks for having me on.
All right, hello, and welcome back to the Chase Thomas Podcast with old friend, the oldest of friends, David Roth.
Hi.
We're both so old now, man.
I'm 66 years young. I've got had a lot of work done. I guess it's obvious because there is a visual element to this. Yeah, so these are all new, the cheekbones.
How's your vision? Because can I tell you a funny story about my vision?
Yeah, go ahead.
Okay. So I'm wearing glasses. I'm nearsighted. I've been nearsighted since I was like 16 years old. And it's gotten like I was able to get by with just needing them at night for a while and like just to see the board in class which is everything about just adolescence is stupid and what kids will pick on, like, oh, you can't see the board. What a loser. What are you? What?
Yeah. How is that love to look at what's on the, what teacher writes on the board. That's where I get my lessons. But I know.
It's so stupid, but
whatever
it was
you
one
can't
of those things,
do.
Yeah, you're self-conscious about it, and you're like, this is silly. Why was I ever self-conscious about it? And it's just, as I've gotten older, it's gotten progressively worse, and then it like there was a big jump in one of my eyes a year or two ago, and I was like, oh, that's not good. Where I was, he was showing me the prescription, and like when the optometrist is like, is that, you can't see that one? And
you
I'm
don't
like,
want to see any face acting from those guys when you're in there. Not
yeah, you're like, oh, this is bad. And then, but I've never worn contacts. I tried it when I was like, when I was in high school.
You know, I haven't either.
It's
I've never
horrible.
Done it. Yeah.
Did you know that it's mostly a woman thing that if you look at the, just who buys contacts and like how that works, it's such a small male market. Like
really?
Very, very small. It's mostly women. And I asked my optometrist about this because I was like, my wife, who has perfect vision and didn't have to deal with it, my mom has worn contacts her entire life. And I asked, I was like, it seems like there is, but is that actually true? And he's like, oh, well, it's because women are used to just putting on like mascara and makeup and doing weird stuff with their eyes all day and moving around their eyelids and stuff to get ready in the morning. That is just something they just add naturally to your day to day. And men are like, I'm not spending 2 minutes like just doing this just draconian eye pull and stuff in this thing in my eye.
I can't tell you how gratifying it is to hear this because that's always been the reason why, especially it's like I basically stopped playing basketball when my eyesight got bad enough that I needed to be wearing my glasses out there and I wasn't going to have them. I had them get broken.
You weren't
going to
do the Horace Grant thing.
No, I should have. I actually did. So rec specs, surprisingly, extremely expensive. Like you basically, I could have gotten like a pair of Gucci frames or I could have gotten the Chris Sabo models. Like it was, but it was like value neutral, like $20 difference. So, but I could have, the easier way there would have been to just get contact lenses and wear them for sports, which is what you're supposed to do. And the whole of the reason why I didn't do it is like, I don't want to touch my own eyeball.
Yes.
Like I don't want anything to do with these. Like they're important to me. I like to use them for the things I use my eyes for, but like no touching of any kind. Nothing goes in. Like hopefully nothing comes out. Like that's just, those are the rules. And yeah, I mean, it is definitely, it makes sense that that would be people that like are used to inconveniencing themselves for like stupid beauty standard reasons would be like, this is just one other stupid thing I have to do.
Right.
But like, I'm not doing that. Like if I could avoid it.
And he's like, yeah, men are such babies with this stuff where he's like, I've had just like muscle, like just jacked up men to like try to get contacts in. And it's just like pulling teeth. Like it's one of those things. And I spent, I kid you not, an hour practicing. So my wife had a mandate. She was like, look, you can do the glasses, no glasses, whatever. But for the wedding, you're wearing contacts. And like it was this looming black cloud for the last like 2 months before my wedding.
You'd have to buck up at least once and touch the eye.
Here's what I did though. And the most, and all my best friends who were in the wedding were like, this is the most Chase thing I've ever heard. Where I have a good relationship with my optometrist and I spent an hour trying to get it in and trying to figure it out. And I was like,
I don't trust myself on wedding day. Like, this is not going to happen. Like, I'm not, this is clearly not for me. My eyes are red now because of this whole experience. I hate all of this. This whole thing is terrible. And I was like, can I come in on my wedding day? Can we just meet up and you just pop these bad boys in? And then I'm on my way and I'm ready to go. And he was like, absolutely. So I had to, they were like,
if it's a
where
one
are you going?
You should.
My
you
wedding know, morning.
Get
like,
their
I
makeup
just...
done on their wedding day. I mean, it's like, this is, you should treat yourself. It's your day to be a princess.
Treat yourself. And that's what I did with those contacts and put them in. And they feel great. It's like, wow, what an amazing thing. And then you're like, the whole pulling out process. So before we went on our honeymoon the next day, he was not there because most optometrists are not open on Sundays. Mm-hmm. So I was like, sleeping in them. Terrible. Like, I had one
they,
eye.
They are very clear that you're not supposed to do that.
I know. And I was like, can I just invite my optometrist to the wedding just so he can get my eyes out, get my contacts out at the end of it? But it was a whole thing. And I remember just the feeling. And I was like, we can't go on the road to the honeymoon until like I stop at an optometrist. And I found one like on the way to Asheville. And it was perfect. I was just like, I need you to rip these bad. I was like, hey, I'm going to preface this. This is a weird request. I don't need new frames or anything like that. I just need you to rip these contacts out of my eyes because my eyes are burning and I got to go. I got things.
Do they
to
even
do.
Have like a price schedule for that? Like, is it the sort of, they like, what do you charge? Just be like, just touch my eyes. And just very briefly, there's a thing in them.
Yes.
You know what it is.
I think they're
is
more
like
concerned
$20?
About like the legal ramifications of messing up my eye by doing the process. And I was like, I'll sign whatever. Like, if you you blind me, I'm okay with the consequences here because I just need these out. Whatever you got to do. Because I'm not going to get them out myself. But
I feel like that's definitely, like, contact lenses are for people who, especially, like, in my 20s, would have been, like, I was not responsible enough to have mm-hmm. those. Because I would have been the person that, like, left them in for, like, 5 days. Because I was 1,000%. Like, I was busy. Oh, like, yeah, just, that's stupid.
What, like, we're at the bar, and they're just like, what's going on? Like, your eyes are, like, dripping. Like, there's red. Like, when was the last time you took your contact? You're like, oh, contacts. That's
right.
Right.
Those have been those. In for a while. Wow. Okay. Yeah. Not, it's
no.
not for me.
And my mom has this whole process. I've always seen her growing, like, just growing up. That's what she did. Like, her thing. And it was just organized and well-planned. And I was like, no, that's never going to be me. That's never going to happen. Maybe one day I'll get LASIK or something. But even for LASIK, I think you might need to, like, put me under because I don't know if I can do the whole laser because was a mistake. Looking at what they actually do is a mistake, David. Yes. I don't know if you've seen the process like the big gadgets and stuff, and you're like, oh, this is terrifying.
It's like a James Bond villain scenario. Like, you're definitely like, they're like, I expect you to die, you know, and you're like, okay, well, I'll see you in half an hour when you're done fixing my eyesight. But it is very like, I think that this is the lowest amount of intervention that you can do, basically, like just to get me back to normal. My sight isn't bad. It, you know, it gets worse. I go like, you know, half a prescription down every couple of years or whenever I need to get stuff like replaced. I can see okay without them.
Can you
not
drive?
Great. I wouldn't drive without them, no. Okay. Not at this point. I mean, I can drive in the sense that like the broad strokes are there, but like reading a sign or something like that, I'd have to be real close to it. And it's weird though that you said that like, when you realized that you needed glasses, because I remember I didn't get mine until I was a senior in college, I think.
Oh, wow.
And it was, and I definitely needed them before then, but it would be like, I would get to class late and then would just, I remember saying this to a friend once. I was like, it's stupid that I get there late. I get to everything late, but like you get there late in the big classrooms and like, you can't even see what they're writing on the board. And he was like, no, you can see it. Like, like it's definitely like anyone can see it. Like, I think that this might be a you problem. It wasn't even that big a classroom. And I was like, oh, like, so not everybody is like struggling if they're not in the first five rows to like read something that a guy is writing in chalk consciously as big as he can write it.
This is such a guy thing, too. Like, that is the most guy thing ever. It's like, man, it sucks getting to class late where you can't see the board because I got in there late and I'm too far up. And they're like, nope, we can all see it pretty far up.
And it would just never occur to me that it wasn't supposed to be that way. That is very, like, I mean, that's been, like, a running thing on the Distraction Podcast with Drew, is that both of us sort of are, like, in awe of what disgusting idiots our younger selves were. That he was like,
yes,
I had a Foreman grill, I used it to cook dinner every night, like I needed, but like, like, until I had like a serious girlfriend, I didn't know you were supposed to clean it. I thought it just cleaned itself. And it was just like so gnarly to imagine like that version of him like 25-year-old Drew Bear just hammering some chicken thighs in that thing. All the fat runs off, and he's like, done. Perfect. Do it again tomorrow.
Do you know, in my freshman year of college, I'd forgotten about this story, but I had somehow, in my suburban Atlanta life growing up, I had never actually used blinds. Like, there was never... I just had never used them. Like, it was never...
Just, like, hammer a towel over the window or something? Like, what was going on?
My room... So we had this spinner. How can I frame this? I lived in like one house for 18 years, mm-hmm. and like my room was the only one I really would mess with. But it had like I don't know how to explain it. It's like a little stick, and it mm-hmm. literally just twirled up and down. That's all I would do every day. I just twirled the stick if I wanted to open my blinds, and I'd twirl it the other way if I didn't.
Okay.
Those weren't a thing in college, so I went in my and I remember like just staring at my blinds and just being intimidated by like what I'm supposed to do because I was like, I don't know. This is really embarrassing. I need to ask someone how to use the blinds. So I remember I called my best friend. I was like, hey, I need your help. And he came over. He's like, what's going on? And I was like, I don't know how to open my blinds. And he had to show me how to, like, the whole up and down and, like, this whole thing. Had no idea.
That's
never
really,
done.
I think that's a beautiful story for a bunch of reasons. Mm-hmm. First of all, just on the merits, no notes. Very funny thing to not know how to operate.
Yes.
but... I like the bro care element where you like called somebody you trusted and you're like, I forgot how to tie my shoes, dude. And he's like, yes. All right, I'll be right over, like to show you how to like put the choo-choo through the tunnel and pull it tight.
These stories can't happen anymore though because everyone's documenting everything. So this is like right before like the Instagram's just for pictures and Snapchat's not a thing. So there's no video of my friend just recording me in my... In my dorm room being like, look at this dork not knowing how to do
last moments of anonymity. Yes. I also feel like you picked a tough one because that's like one of those things where as much as there is on YouTube, I think there's probably not a how to use blinds instructional video on there. That's like one that they just they haven't gotten to making that one yet. Yeah. Like no one thought of it.
Yeah. Well, but, there you go.
And there's just no way of knowing if they're good or not. Like there's a video to which I return often is... Have you seen the video of that woman making an old-fashioned that involves, like, emptying, like, half a bottle of Jim Beam into a pint glass with some ice cubes? Like, just because it's an instructional video does not mean you should follow those instructions. Like, sometimes
but there's so many people that do, though. I know that so many people watch that and we're like, I guess that's what we're supposed to do. That's how it works.
I think it would be hilarious to make that drink. Make yourself just a 12-ounce old-fashioned. It's got a bunch of, like... Two orange wedges, 16 ounces of straight bourbon whiskey.
Oh my god, I don't even know. Like, I guess the other thing too is just like cleaning your laptop. Where you're like, I didn't know you could clean it. I just thought it once it got dirty enough and nasty enough, throw it away.
Yeah, stopped working.
Yeah,
yeah. There was I mean, college was great for that too, just because you were confronting like the limits of like how babied you were, and there was always somebody that like. Had it weirder. Like I had a guy on my floor that had never cut his own toenails. He was from a foreign country. His grandma had done it. That was just how his family did it. And like no one walked him through it, but they were like, it's just like cutting your fingernails but a little bit harder, and you gotta lean over and use, you know, they're on your feet, of course. But then there was still stuff for me that like I had done laundry, but I had only done laundry like in the machines in my parents' basement. And so you go to like these like coin op things and they're all big. And I was like, where I have to like, I was really into cleaning the lint trap as a kid. That was a real like,
you're just
like
terrified of burning down the building.
Yes, exactly. Mm. Like I was like, this is not going to be my fault because I'm like washing my like circle logo, the game hats over and over again, you know? And in this case, like, yeah, it was all these like industrial machines. Like I was, it's like the cavemen in 2001 just like banging a stick on the side of it trying to get it to do what I needed it to do.
Incredible.
Well, now look at us, functioning adults,
married,
doing own podcast thing. Mics
I mean podcast this is, mics
it could happen to you, anybody that's listening or watching. Eventually
I'm,
you
like
could
I get
learn
comments
to...
sometimes still like they're like, what is that hair all over your mic? I have a floof dog, like I have a Keyshond that just sheds off. She's asleep right behind me right now. I will clean this, and this will be full of her hair by the next day. It's just, hey, when you have a floof dog, it's over. Like, I've given up. Like,
yeah, I mean, it's
good, everywhere.
Good content, I'm assuming. Like, you got a cute animal to photograph and stuff like
I do.
That.
Like, the wedding photos of her, we got her coming in at the end, like, running down to see us. There's some, she's a very, very front-facing member of our family. She's all about it.
Being able to, that's like, and also respect you for getting it together enough to have like a dog when you got married.
Yes.
I know a lot of people that like, that wasn't, they weren't at that stage in their life until like you get married first, then you're like, okay, I can do a couple of basic things. Maybe now I can have a more involved pet.
Yeah.
Like I've had a turtle for 20 odd years, but that's a very low impact pet.
What is his name or her name?
Marvin is the surviving one. There was another turtle passed over the winter. Which was sad, but it's like
were they
literally
siblings?
I don't know. So I bought them out of like a drywall bucket on Canal Street in Chinatown in New York. Uh-huh. They were just selling. You could get two of them and a little plastic container and some food for $20. This was probably like 2002. And I, it was a total impulse buy. Like just me, I like met friends for lunch down there, and I was like, "Oh, these guys look cute," and I brought them home. And then like later in the game.
Yeah,
I learned that turtles live for like 40 years. So I am pot committed to these dudes. The one, George, who died in December was like at least 20, you know? Like he had a good long life.
Yeah.
And yeah, like as far as I know.
40 years?
Yeah. So I took Marvin to the vet recently and the doctor was like, you know, he's not going to live another 20 years. He's going to live at least another 10. So that's like a 30-year lifespan. He's healthy. That's just how it is. There's a pond in Central Park in Manhattan that is full of just this type of turtle, and I'm sure because they're not like native to here, but I think it is like the result of people that got them on a whim, and then either they were like moving into a no turtles co-op or just were like I did not sign up for 25 more years.
Like everyone does the Googling after getting the turtle.
Yes.
Where it's,
and then they're like, oh, so this will outlive me. That's cool. Yeah. I'll just put that in my will so that.
Who gets the turtle?
Yeah.
That's amazing. What kind of turtle is it?
It's a red-eared slider, which is like one of the real charming traits that they have is that they're covered in salmonella. So every time I touch them, I have to wash my hands.
Oh my God. Even if it's like in your house, like they still just carry it, even if it like isn't going anywhere
else.
It's
like naturally occurring. They're just, well, I mean, I don't know if it is exactly salmonella. It's basically like it will have the same effect on you. Like you have to be very careful with it.
Wow.
But yeah, they're dumb creatures. The reason I took him to the vet was that he had gotten a tummy ache and had barfed up like 40 pebbles that he had eaten when I had pebbles in the tank like 15 years ago. I haven't had them in there in a long time. And the vet was like, yeah, they do that. They'll eat anything that's around. They're fine.
That's wild.
Yeah, they're completely unreasonable creatures. But a lot easier to handle than a floof dog. I never have to clean anything up except for the tank every month or so.
There you go. Yeah. It's funny. The first thing I caught actually as a kid growing up in Atlanta was a snapping turtle.
Those are scary, though.
Those are scary.
They'll mess you up.
Snapping turtles, and like they obviously broke the line. But like you're pulling it out, and it's just the mouth of a snapping turtle up close is wild. And it wasn't just in a random... pond in Tequila, which means nothing to you, David, but more in the country of Atlanta, and it was wild. Like snapping turtles are huge and terrifying, but also I don't know,
and they will show up play. I remember there was a rumor of one being in the like sort of town like pool swimming holey type thing that we had where I grew up. And it was, you know, it was like managed by the town. It probably wasn't there, but there was like an island in it, and everybody was like, do not go there, there's a snapping turtle there, like it'll like I heard it killed a kid, you know, just, but they're hideous.
Probably not,
you know?
Yeah.
Like even before you could like look things up online, it was like very clear. If you see like a picture of it, you're like, this is not a situation that you want to mess around with at all.
We do have some other stuff to assess.
I was gonna say, this has just been pet chat. You want to talk about some of the stuff that you talk about on the podcast?
No, I mean, Pet Chat's good. We're very pro pet on this podcast. What are you reading right now, David? What have you found yourself
reading? I am reading, so I just finished reading a couple of books, sports books, for this reading series that I do with Patrick Sauer. So they were good. I read Ben Mathis Lilly's book about Michigan football, and called The Hot Seat, and then Jason Reed's book called The Rise of the Black Quarterback, because we did like an event with them. So now I'm back to like reading the actual, you know, books that I read that aren't about sports. I had started one called Entangled Life that's about mushrooms and like just sort of like the way that they work It's incredible. It's very dense. It might be the sort of thing where I have to like put it down to read whatever the next sports book is at some point. But it is brilliantly written, and they're the most amazing creatures on Earth. Like, I can't believe that mushrooms and, like, in general, that, like, fungi are real.
You and my wife would be best friends, David. She, like, whenever we're walking around, she stops immediately when she sees a fairy circle or anything mushroom-related. Very into mushrooms.
Is she on the... Is she, like, at that level where she's comfortable picking them and cooking them, or is it...
So my wife... God bless her for a billion reasons, but she's like very trusting with just nature and whatever she sees out there. So like, if
there are risks to this.
Yeah, no risks. Where she will eat any berry off any tree, like no matter where we're at. Like, oh, raspberry, and I'm like, can't do it.
We'll see what happens.
Yeah, she's a free spirit, and one of the reasons I love her is I am not that way whatsoever. Where I'm just like, that'll kill you. That right there is pesticides and everything else where I'm like, nope, don't trust it. Don't trust it. But she's like, yeah, I mean, I'm certain if the mushrooms that we see were not in people's yards, by and large, she would rip them out and be like, yeah, it's fine. It's just a mushroom.
So I have a couple of coworkers that are like, they're capable. They've like done whatever, the 10,000 hours of like identifying. They know stuff. And so they're confident doing it. Like Giddy Nathan and Patrick Redford from Defector will both like, go
what's up,
find
YouTubers?
Mushrooms.
I missed that
he brings that energy to finding like morels, you know, in the woods. And that's cool. Like, I love eating mushrooms. I like cooking with them. Like, and I like the idea of getting them for free. That sounds tight.
Yeah.
But there's just, there's so much I don't know that I have never.
It'd be such
I would
a dumb
not
way to die.
Them. It is. The super, and you're in pain the whole time. And so the whole time you're doing it, you're like, this is all my fault. It's all because I didn't want to go pay for a mushroom at the supermarket.
It's one of those Nick Swardson from like 17, 18 years ago had a bit where he was like, dying from poisoning yourself is just the most embarrassing way to go out, because he's like, did you ever happen to Nick? What? He was poisoned? Oh my God, by who? Nick.
Yeah. You never want to go out playing a prank on yourself. That should not be a cause of death. You got to do better than that. Yep.
There you go. Do you read, do you find yourself, cause like I balance like my daily reading. I try and go back and forth, and I try, like, I think I found for me, like talking about sports for a living and reading and writing about sports, that like reading nonfiction sports books are hard.
Yeah.
Cause I think I identify more with novel. Like, I just, finished up How Lucky, Will's book.
Oh yeah. It's supposed to be
so
great.
Good.
Yeah, we had him on the podcast to talk about it. Drew read it and loved it. I have not read it, but
it's very good, and it's an easy read. Like, Will's writing is very easy to read. Like, he's got one of those things that I feel like if you're not a writer, you might miss, but he has the short sentence mastery that is so difficult to come by, because I am an M-dash lover. I am a... It's so hard to shorten and, like, to really craft your sentences in a way that just hit one... Like, it's a special talent that he has that I wish I had.
I envy it because I don't have it, but it is also like, it's that, you know, there's something to this. I think that, like, depending on who you read, when you're like figuring out how you want to write, you know, you sort of, for me anyway, that like, I just assimilated all of the different things that I liked from the writers that were important to me when I was young. And then I've just been mushing them together in different formations and adding new writers on top of it ever since. But what that winds up with, because I'm also an M-dash boy, is like this kind of like impacted, you know, you can wind up with like very long, very show-offy sentences where like, and I do my best to keep that in check. But the writers where you like don't really even notice them writing, where it's just the sort of thing where it like everything sort of goes down the way it's supposed to. There's no, you know, like sort of like extra pyrotechnics that like that. I don't know. It speaks to like a pretty enlightened, I think, way of thinking about it too, because you're just like, you're just telling the story. You're not making yourself part of it, which I have, you know, when I read the blogs that I'm really having a hard time writing, you know, I can still kind of force it out, get it on the website, because that's like part of the job. But they feel overworked in a way that like when I'm right and when I'm feeling good about what I'm writing, like it's never easy for me. Like I, like just have a hard time focusing on stuff to a certain extent, but you can see when I'm forcing it. And I think like you can definitely tell with Will, I think it's always been the case. I mean, with his writing, like whether it's movies or sports or whatever, that like when he's right, it's just like, you know, one long finished thought presented mm-hmm. ably. Like, it's a great thing to be able to do.
Yeah.
I find, I, to your point about nonfiction sports books too, like
yeah.
I wouldn't be reading them, I don't think, as much if it wasn't for the obligation to do the bit with Patrick. And it's good in some ways. It's like, I've read some really interesting books that way. And you know, and I get them, you know, mailed to my home. So that's nice. But yeah, like, I feel like I get a lot of sports in the monitors every day as it is. And
right.
Like, so the idea of, even when I'm interested in stuff like this, I read Howard Bryant's book about Ricky Henderson, and it's great. Mm. And I was fascinated by Ricky Henderson as a kid, like, and he's played for so long that, you know, like, I cheered for him, you know, as an adult too, like when he was with the Mets and I was in my 20s. And even there, it's a terrific book, and it's got a lot of really interesting, like, it's sort of, the first third of it is basically like a history of the Great Migration as told through like Oakland high school sports of the like 50s, 60s, and 70s. It's terrific. It's like really interesting stuff. And yet, if left to my own devices, I would just read a novel like all the time, because that's like the sort of vacation I'm trying to get from reading, is like, you get that more from fiction than from anything else.
Yeah, I think that's because I'm right there with you, because if I'm my bookshelf is all right here. And I mean, I'm looking at it right now. I would say it's probably 70% novels and then probably like 20% political nonfiction and then 10% sports nonfiction. I wonder if it's for other people, like people who are accountants or whatever for their day jobs. They're like, oh, awesome sports thing that I can spend a lot of time jumping into because I don't have the time to jump into this. It's like some cocktail chatter for me that I can just talk about this new sports book that I read, and like, oh, this is cool, do you know about this, about this person, and blah blah blah. And it's like, that's not me whatsoever. Like, books are my escape because I spend so much of my day, like, I have to read, like you said, on the monitors. Like, we have to spend so much time on PFF and Football Outsiders and ESPN Plus and everything else that you're like, that's just so much of my day. That's not what I want to do when I'm on the couch.
I'm always really like wary of complaining too much about that, because it's like, once it became clear that I wasn't going to be a professional athlete when I was like 12 or 10 or younger, it was like, if the second best thing was like, you're just gonna like think about baseball all the time and write about it whenever you feel like it, that sounds great. Like, that is really good. That's better than like, I'm happier doing that than I would be like having a real job that contributed something to society, you know, for instance. And yet, like, there is this element of it where it's like, even if it's something that you care about, even if you'd be on PFF that many hours every day at your regular job just because, like, you want to know more about Justin Herbert, you want to know everything about Justin Herbert or whatever, there's still the challenge of, like, then have, like, feeling like you're obligated to do it. Really just, like, changes the whole valence of it, the vibe of it.
If you wrote a book, do you think you would do a novel? Would you follow the Drew and Will path?
I mean, I wrote a novel when I was in my 20s and it didn't work.
Why didn't it work?
Because I wasn't a good writer yet. I mean, also, it, like, I wrote it. I mean, I finished it. I had an agent who tried to sell it, and maybe it would be different now because I have like Twitter followers. You know, at the time, it's like there wasn't even any of that. So there was no way to, I was just another, you know, butthead trying to write a novel about being sad. And there's a, you know, those are abundant and of low value. I would love to write a novel. I think if I had to, you know, write a book, period, I think it would be easier to do like a collection of essays or whatever, but I've never really gotten it together to even try to do that. I mean, I think some of it is that like the process of writing like helps me figure the world out from one moment to the next. And so I really am like, in that way, habitually like a blogger, like that. It's just like, as I take things as they come in that way, and I process them. And some of the more involved stuff I do, it's like, you know, you read, like, if you're going to write stuff about like Brett Favre and this whole thing in Mississippi, like, you're going to read like 2 years worth of reporting from Mississippi Today. It's not the sort of thing where you like read a blog, react, read and react. And yet, like, even that is like, it's a discrete process, you know, like you sort of know when you're done. And maybe I'm like putting books on a pedestal, or maybe I'm letting myself off the hook on like doing some actual harder work. But that feels like so much more open-ended a process that I've always found it really intimidating just to think about. The thing that you can say for Will and Drew that they have in common is a very different writers in their way, is that both of those guys also just sit down and bang stuff out.
Mm-hmm.
Like Drew's a machine. Like he writes thousands of words a week. Mm. And like, and he's very, you know, for a guy that writes all the time about like goofy stuff, like he is very orderly in his approach, you know, like he like gets up at a certain time, does this, you know, he's got kids and stuff. So some of it is like sort of thrust upon him, but he breaks his day down into that. Whereas like I spend half the day just like sitting in some weird position on the couch, like thinking about something, like maybe I write something that day, maybe I don't, but it's like, and that's, you know, I would need to whip myself into shape to a certain extent to, I think, even be able to think about doing a book just because.
Maybe Drew could just drop off one of his kids at Uncle
Get my
David's
day started
for
4 hours earlier. Yeah, because they're like, somebody needs to make me a sandwich for school. And I'd be like, sounds terrible, man. Sounds terrible for you.
Oh my God, I'm not prepared for any of that in my life. But it is true. Like it,
you just got married, man. Give it. Don't worry about it yet. You got plenty of time to enjoy this stuff. I enjoyed that part of the being married so much that we just kept doing it.
Yeah.
And didn't have kids. So like, look at us.
It's
now.
Amazing though how I didn't realize this until I got married. But I mean, even with the engagement party and stuff like that. So I got to be careful with how I frame this. But the unsolicited advice that comes your way very quickly is. Yeah. Insane, like, yep. And just the now you're gonna have three, or you should have two, or you're gonna do this, and you're gonna love this, and you're not gonna like this, and it's
like, are you like playing weird fantasy football with my life right now?
Yes.
Like, come on, man. This I hated that stuff so much.
You seem like a two kid family, like that. What are you talking about?
Like, you're profiling because of my skull shape? Like, are you profiling me right now? Like, it's weird.
So weird.
But everybody, especially too, like once you. Like sort of like start those like outward markers of like who you are. I mean, it's obvious if you're like wearing a kid around, then everybody's gonna be like, can I feed him, can I name him, you know, like, does he like get in the way? But just like having a wedding ring on, like especially you're still like in this, because you, it's been a matter of what, weeks?
It has been 12 days.
Jeez. Yeah, so you're still in the stage where it's like every now and then you're like, what is this, like on my hand. I remember this was like, if you read it in a short story, you would think it was too on the nose, but it kept happening to me. Made me change how I would be. I would take the subway to work. And the way I used to do it was I'd hold a book in my right hand and hold the sort of the bar when you're standing up so you don't fall down in the other. And, you know, left hand has the wedding ring on it. And so for like a week, I would do that and reach up, you know, just the way with no thinking, the way I'd done it for 10 years living in New York before that, and just get the loudest metal on metal, like, pang from like just driving my ring into the thing.
Yeah.
And it was like every time I was startled, and finally so I've changed it up now. Now I'm a right hand pole holder and left hand book guy. But it was like, once you get to the point in this process where it doesn't feel weird that it's on your hand, like you are on the glide path.
There you go.
At this point, after 12 days after being married, I was mostly just proud of myself that I'd gotten through the wedding okay.
Same.
And that's a lot, man. And that's real though. I think that's reasonable.
I mean, you could experience this, or it can identify with this too. It's just that, like, I've never been that tired.
Yeah.
At my wedding night, like, I've never been that tired, and
you're,
it's a different kind of
high
tired.
Alert the whole time too. You're trying to like.
But you have to talk to everybody. You're so, and you do so many emotional conversations, and it's so draining because you're just really giving a lot all day long, and you are. It's a different kind of tired that I could not begin to describe to people, where like that Sunday morning we woke up and we're like, okay, that's over. Like it's a whole thing.
We had a great time at ours, but I remember my friend Joel, I remember after he got married, a little bit older than me, got married earlier, and I remember before mine, I was like, so what was it like? Like, how did you feel when it was over? Because I was already looking forward to that part. Like, the party was great, but I was just looking forward to like getting back to normal.
Same.
And he said that it was like, it felt like he had survived a gunfight.
Yeah.
And I was like, that's a bit much, you know, like, and yet, like, I do remember that feeling of exhaustion, because there's something so dreamlike about being at your own wedding. And it's like, not everybody that you care about is there, but a very much higher percentage of the people in your life that you care about are in one room with you. Like, much higher than we'll ever be in that room with you again, probably for the rest of your life. There's something really dreamlike and weird about that. about like you can just look around and recognize every face and everybody means something to you, you know,
and they'll never all be in one place, like
right, and like
again.
You know, you'll continue to see them, you'll continue to care about them, but like there will never be an opportunity for like the parents of my elementary school friends to meet like my uncle.
Yeah.
Like people that I went to college with, you know, like, but you know, that's, I hope they all like enjoyed the buffet the one time that they all got to party together.
Yeah.
It's like where I landed on it.
I mean, we had the, I think we had a lot of crossover there in our experiences. And, you know, it's nice. Like you, I was just, when you're done with it, but like that week of, man, that it's tense because you're just hoping everything goes. I remember I was just telling people, I'm like, this is why I broke my foot, David, is because.
It was a pre-wedding thing?
It was a pre-wedding thing. Oh, so I did the whole wedding with no nothing on my foot. I had to power through that day.
It's your flu game.
It was my flu game. Speaking of flu game, Michael Jordan broke the exact same thing I did in 1985.
Wow.
Navicular stress fracture in his third metatarsal.
Did you break it doing the same stuff?
Basically the same.
Dunking on Michael Moses Malone?
Yeah. no, I've been a runner for 16 years. And that apparently takes a toll when you enter your 30s. And I've never broken a bone, ever. But I was running a lot that week. Like, I was upping my time.
Yeah.
Because I was stressed, man. Like, with grad school, with the wedding, with everything else, I was just like, that's my happy place. That's what I do to clear my head and to kind of, you know, get through the day. And I was on mile 3, and I was, I don't know if you knew this or not, but Knoxville, Tennessee, rocky. It's
heard
a little
that.
Rocky.
One of the
very
things
hilly.
You know. Yep.
Yeah. And it's very hard on your body. Very different than when I was running the streets of Atlanta. I'll say that. Yeah. And I just took a hard step off the sidewalk on one of my streets, and I just put so much stress on the top of my foot, and I heard it pop. Like, I had noise-canceling headphones on, and I still heard it, which terrified me to no end. Because if I heard it through that, then my pop must have
been... Like, somebody walking by on the street heard it then. Like,
yeah, it would have been like, that's disgusting. What just happened there? And I just... It was rough. So I stayed off it Wednesday and Thursday. And then Friday was still mostly off it, icing it and all that kind of stuff. And I got an x-ray, and they were like, that's when they found out like there was that. And they were like, you can't really do more damage to it over the wedding. Like, it's kind of already broken. And it's like, the whole thing, too, it's like the now-canceled certain comedian who had this bit, where it's very true. When you get to a certain age and you're not an athlete, and they're just like, oh, it's just shitty now. When you just tear something or you mess, it's like Ozzy Albies like tore his foot, like broke his foot the same way, and he had immediate surgery, and he's back, and he's rehabbing hard, and then he's just back to normal. They don't do that with normal citizens. When you break your foot, it's a very different experience where they're like, you're going to be in a boot, and we'll see what happens.
Like, there's no circumstances under which they're going to be like, Mr. Roth, we recommend Tommy John surgery. Yeah. Like, we're going to get you to Neil Ella Trash right away. Like, no, they'd just be like, you're not going to ever throw good again, which is fine.
That's like, 100% what they
were
doing.
Were you throwing well before? You know, it's just like, that element of it.
You're just going to be in pain, and you're going to just see how much you can withstand, but your foot might not be the same.
Point in the wedding where you were able to enjoy yourself? I hope that you
did. Oh, yeah.
All right, good.
But I will say, the end
of the
night,
I was stressed as hell beforehand, but it was that there's some point where you realize that nothing you do is going to change what's going to happen, that it's just in God's hands. It's in a matter of gravity, whatever you want to call it. At that point, you're just sort of like, all right, well, now it's a party and I can like have a beer and do what I need to do.
Well, that's the other part. You just take your mind off it. That's the big part of it, is like, I was not thinking about my foot. So there's part of the endorphins and that you're not aware of what's going on, really. And then at the end of the night, though, so
that's when you crash and realize,
oh my God,
you
like the pain was immeasurable at the end of the night. But I will say, this was something that scared me, because I got really mad at the photographers where I was. They probably still think I was joking, but I was so mad because they asked me to dip my wife as we're going through the sparklers and the end for the photos. I get all that. The problem with dipping is you have to put all of your weight on my broken foot, like my weight, but also my wife's weight, to just do that. Like, that excess that I could not do. Like, that was one thing I told her. Like, I cannot do that. I'm sorry, but, like, there's no way I'm going to be able to handle that.
Did they have a counter argument? They were like, no, we always take these photos.
Well, no, it was just in the moment. So everyone's like, yeah, Dipper. So everyone at my wedding is just, like, in on it. So I have no choice to try, but to try, because everyone's staring at me to do this thing. So I knew, like, I was mad because I was like, I'm backed into a corner here. I've got to at least attempt it in the moment. When I tell you, like, I've never screamed internally more than when I got halfway down and I was like, nope. And I, like, hopped around and I was like, we're going back to the cabin. We're done. Like, this is the end of the wedding. I can't do anymore. I almost just fractured my foot worse and I'm going to lose my foot if we stay at this wedding any longer. So we need to go.
That's a matter of priorities. Like, it's important to be married. It's important to get good photos. You're going to need that foot for, like, pretty much the rest of your life.
Yes. So I'm in the boot until Halloween and we're gonna see what happens, but I mean, like I said, like, they, if they were like, oh, we need surgery, I'm like, yeah, great, not doing it. I'm not putting bolts in my foot and just doing this for 6 months. I'm just not gonna have a great foot, my left foot anymore.
I bet it'll get, from what I remember with stress fractures, I had them when I was in cross country, or I had, well, like, shin splints or whatever, basically that, and that it is like the junior varsity version of that. And, like, you know, some rest will do you a lot of good. And I know you're, I mean, if you've been running for that long, then you don't need me to tell you that there's probably a sneaker-related solution that someone is going to recommend. I have no idea if any
of that's terrified to run, though. But apparently, like, when you do this, like, you're 20 to 30% more likely to break the same foot in the same year.
Yeah.
So, like, I don't know if I'm going to, like, getting through that roadblock. I'm just going to be a swimmer. I'm telling
you, I was going to say, everybody I know that.
I'm transitioning to swimming. I'm the old guy at the pool now, just doing my laps.
My friends that were running freaks like that all wound up having to become swimmers too. For them, it's like usually the back, but it's the same deal. Like, it's just,
it's hard in
your
body.
Not something the body's built to do that much. My sister and her husband are both training for the marathon again, and they're doing great, but it's like, there's so much less margin for error at this point. And so they both had, like, injuries that knocked them out of training for, like, you know, you could lose a week, and it's like that.
Yeah.
The way that marathon training is, it's like you kind of can't get that back if it happens close enough to the thing. But I'll be there to see him. We live like a half block from the course, so the New York City Marathon is always a big deal for us.
When is it?
It's November. I want to say the first or second Sunday in November. I don't remember which one. Okay. But it's always cool. It's like a big sort of positive vibe party thing. You know, it's like little kids high-fiving strangers and stuff. So stuff that you like to see.
Yeah.
And then it goes back to being New York instantly as soon as it's over.
The Mets, though, we end on this, David. All right.
We're mortal
enemies.
Yeah.
This weekend.
Because our two teams that are exactly as good as each other are going to play each other. Apparently not in the middle of a bunch of Hurricane Ian weather, though, so that's nice.
Very excited for that, because if that had been moved, like, that's a disaster for Major League Baseball if they have to move that, because you know both fan bases and just teams in general, no matter how the series went, would have been like, doesn't count, this is BS. And it shouldn't have gone this way. So I'm glad we're
all the options. I remember seeing that yesterday with the proposals. It was like, they didn't even mention a neutral site because they knew everybody would freak out. Mm-hmm. But all the other ones were like, they'll just play a doubleheader the day before the wild card game. And it's like, no, that's also bad. There's no options. Like, I'm glad it looks like the weather's going to be good. I have made my peace with whatever outcome there is, because, like, the Mets are good. They brought me a lot of joy this year. Like, it's been a minute since I could have said that and meant it. And, like, I don't know how, you know, obviously if you were to take the two competitive windows that the two teams have, like, I'd for sure rather be the Braves. I just think they've got, like, it's different. You know, the Mets did about as much as you can do just by spending money. And they took a team that was actively bad last year and they made it into a really good one this year. And a lot of that is just getting off-season transactions right. Like, and I wouldn't expect to, like, hail Billy Epler's genius again that many times in the future, but, like, I had some thoughts about the trade deadline not being exactly what I wanted, but they improved their roster a lot. They're good. They're also older, more expensive, and they're on the clock in a way that the Braves aren't. But, you know, they're two really good teams. Like, if you tell me last year at this time that the Mets would be exactly as good as the Braves, and the Braves hadn't even won the World Series yet, I'd be like, hell yeah, let's do it. And now they're like, you know, whatever. I think the Braves and the Mets are both about as good as each other. I think nobody is as good as the Dodgers, and I think the Dodgers are maybe like 10% better than anyone else. But the fun part of October is it doesn't matter.
Yeah, the Braves were not the best team in baseball last year.
No. You know, but
they got hot at the right time.
Yep. And that's always cool when that happens. Like, mm-hmm. I mean, it's annoying when it happens to you,
mm-hmm.
but it is the sort of thing where, yeah, like that's 100% a thing that can work. Not just because October is random and baseball's stupid either. It's like, this is it. Like, this is like, that's the way that the game works. Like, it's not just a function of it being a 5-game series or a 7-game series or, you know, whatever, bullpens being used differently. Like, if you, like, luck into having Jorge Soler abruptly turn into Willie Mays for, like, mm-hmm. a month, like, great.
Yeah.
There you are. How are you feeling about the Braves, I guess, is the question that I would ask.
Can I tell you the worst thing about me being a fan was mm-hmm. last year? And I wonder if you experienced this a little bit. Baseball in October. Like, already football season's going on. The NBA's back in less than a month as well. So this mm-hmm. is, like, go time. Like, everything's back. And you have to be very careful with how you prioritize your sports watching and, like, what you watch and everything. Those games every single night, 4 hours of just intense, like, yeah. I have to sit on the couch and I'm, like, shaking just seeing how it's going night over night while also just having this avalanche of other sports content to watch was exhausting.
Yeah,
like, a deep playoff run for your team is so exhausting that part of me is like, am I up for this again? Am I up for another deep Braves playoff run? Because the games go longer. They're way more intense, way more just emotionally.
Like, you actually feel, like, bad when they lose in a way that, like, for the regular season this year, like, once it became clear that the Mets were good, I was like, fine, I'll have my fun.
Right.
But, like, I don't need to see every inning. I don't need to, like, forensically go over everything. Mm-hmm. Like, they're fine. I'll come back. You know,
like, we're gonna be fine in October. Like, we're just gonna be there. Like, we just check in and we do our thing, but they're fine.
Yeah. But, like, that doesn't get you prepared emotionally for, like, the heavy lifting of that. It's, the last time the Mets made a deep playoff run was 2015. I covered that. I was at home, but I was at Citi Field for all the games in the NLCS and the World Series, and I was a fucking mess.
Exactly.
Like, I just couldn't hack it. And I had never really been in, like, a press box for a game I cared about before. You know, I'd been, like, here and there of different games, different credentials, and, like, you know, you show up, you take your notes, you go interview a guy, and you're done. And for this one, it was like, because I cared and because I had really, I think, thought that the Mets would never make the World Series again, as long as they were owned by the Wilpons, that, like, I'd be there, you know, white knuckling it, trying not to be an ass in front of, like, Pedro Gomez or any of the few guys that were in the press box that I, like, recognized and respected and didn't want to have them be like,
this is why
that
I will butthead never be
started crying when Daniel Murphy made an error or whatever, you know, like, but I would go out every game. So I, you know, had my computer, did the, you know, got set up, do the things you got to do. And then for one inning, I would go out, I'd buy one beer and I would just power walk around the stadium and drink that beer and yell. And, like, if, like, a stranger wanted to high five me because, like, Juan Uribe did something good, I would high five that stranger. But that was my time to, like, try to be a normal person. And then I would have to go back up, you know, or be myself, I guess. And then I would have to go back up and try to be a professional again. I'm looking forward to, you know, obviously I will write about whatever happens there, but I am very much looking forward to, like, watching those games at home, being able to go to bed, like, when I want to, not when, like, Mike Moustakas is done talking, you know, and, like, and then when the 7 train delivers me. So I'm looking forward to it. For now, it's easy for me to say that. Like, we'll see how I feel. Like, if we wanted to check back in 3 weeks and we both just absolutely look like shit with, like, big Pete Davidson rings under our eyes because we can't sleep because of how anxious we are, then, you know, that would be a funny punchline to this. I hope that doesn't happen, but I don't know.
I know, and we'll see what happens. I think this weekend will be fun. It's like predictions. Like, I don't know, man. Baseball's weird. And this weekend, like, we've never seen this before. Like, we've never been in a situation in our adult lives of the Braves and the Mets being exactly the same and being just as good going into the last weekend where everything is on the table. Like, this is just uncharted waters that I have no idea how this is going to go. It's just going to,
like,
be fun.
Yeah. And it, like, it means a lot, but it's not the sort of thing where, like, you're going to wind up having to go home. Like, you're going to wind up having to go play the Dodgers.
If you get this
wild
card spot, like, you don't get the bye, because whoever wins this, you're going to be one of the top 2 seeds. So you're getting a first round bye, which is huge. But also, if you get this, if you're the wild card team, you're getting the Padres probably.
Yeah.
And the Padres have a better road record than home record this year. So that's just terrifying. Like, I have no biz. I do not want any part of the Padres.
Getting, like, definitely that's the part of it where, like, my attempt at being, like, all Buddha nature and cool about this, like, completely falls by the boards, where it's just, like, the idea of being like, congratulations, you made the playoffs. Like, now you have to go deal with, like, yeah, deal with the Padres, deal with the Dodgers. Like, deal, like, no thanks. Like, yeah. At this point, like, the moment of the gratitude vanishes and I become entitled as soon as I get the opportunity. That's just how fan brain works, I guess.
There you go. I mean, big boy's got an owl, pet owl. So it's, yep, everything's coming up Atlanta right now.
Yeah.
Feel good about that.
They're a good team, man. If they weren't the damn Braves, I'd probably like them a lot more. But
there you go. I also got this. This doesn't look this heavy. Mm-hmm. So this is Grimald.
Oh, yeah.
Like, got him in Asheville during our honeymoon, right? Just super cool. I'm a big gargoyle guy. Mm-hmm. Got gargoyle guy.
Very difficult word to say.
All into it. This is made in Atlanta, and I was like, done deal. Like, made in Atlanta. I need to know where this came from, but just the cool stuff like that. So, very big into owls in this.
There's a gargoyle factory in Atlanta?
Apparently. Like, because this,
you gotta
guy
track this
was
down,
made.
Dude. I would like to know more about this.
He's like 25 pounds. This dude is heavy.
Wow.
And he's reading, so his name's Grimald, and yeah, big fan.
Yeah. Congrats on the gargoyle and getting married.
Thank you.
You know, in that order.
Yes.
But yeah, thank you for having me on, dude. I appreciate it.
This was a blast. I'm glad we're able to reconnect, my friend.
Good stuff. Yeah, it's been a minute, but I'm very happy to be able to do it again. So let's, sometime in the next 5 or 6 years, I guess we should pick this back up.
Yeah, I think so. We should do it more often.
David. All right.
Well, don't forget, folks, go subscribe to defector.com, a very good website if you have not already done so. I'm subscribed, been subscribed for how many years now has it been?
We just had our second birthday in early September.
There you go. It's well worth the monthly subscription cost. And listen to The Distraction with Drew and David each week on Apple, Spotify, wherever your podcast. David, thank you so much. And I will talk to you again very
soon.
Sounds
like your dog is up. All right, take care, dude.
You heard that, right?
Yeah, I did.
Please, she's done with the podcast. Bye, right, David.
See you, man.
Nicely done, nephew. Chase Thomas Podcast. Hell yeah.
Normally, being a little extra might be a bit much, but not when it comes to healthcare. That's why United Healthcare's Health Protector Guard fixed indemnity insurance plans, underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, supplement your primary plan so you manage out-of-pocket costs. Learn more at uh1.com.
Mom deserves the best, and there's no better place to shop for Mother's Day than Whole Foods Market. They're your destination for unbeatable savings, from premium gifts to show-stopping flowers and irresistible desserts. Start by saving 33% with Prime on all body care and candles. Then get a 15-stem bunch of tulips for just $9.99 each with Prime. Round out Mom's menu with festive rosé, irresistible berry chantilly cake, and more special treats. Come celebrate Mother's Day at Whole Foods Market.
Hi, this is Craig Robinson from Ways to Win, and support for this podcast comes from Invesco QQQ, the official ETF of the NCAA. The future isn't scary, not realizing its potential, however, could be. Just like on the recruiting trail, I've seen potential come in many forms as a coach. Learn more at Invesco.com/QQQ. Let's rethink possibility. Invesco Distributors, Inc.